ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 हरिनाय श्रीभिर् अमुक्तानाम्
हरिनाय श्रीभिर् अमुक्तानाम्
अमीमांसित कर्मणाम्
अमीमांसित कर्मणाम्
विगताश्रयसः
पापा विगताश्रयसः पापा
लोकयोरुभयोर्कृतः
लोकयोरुभयोर्कृतः.
Translation. Prajapati Daksha said, "My sons were not at all freed from their three debts. Indeed, they did not properly consider their obligations. O Narad Muni, O personality of sinful action, you have obstructed their progress towards good fortune in this world and the next because they are still indebted to the saintly persons, the demigods, and their father." Purport. As soon as a Brahmana takes birth, he assumes three kinds of debts: debts to the great saints, debts to the demigods, and debts to the father. The son of a Brahmana must undergo celibacy, brahmacharya, to clear his debts to the saintly persons. He must perform ritualistic ceremonies to clear his debts to the demigods. And he must beget children to become freed from his debts to his father. Prajapati Daksha argued that although the renounced order is recommended for liberation, one cannot attain liberation unless one fulfills his obligations to the demigods, the saints, and his father. Since Daksha's sons had not liberated themselves from these three debts, how could Narad Muni have led them to the renounced order of life? Apparently, Prajapati Daksha did not know the final decision of the Shastras, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.5.41. Devarshi bhutapta nrinam pitrinam nakin karo nayam nrinin charajan sarvatmana yas sharanam sharanyam Gato mukundam parihritya kartam. Everyone is indebted to the demigods, to the living entities in general, to his family, to the pitas, and so on. But if one fully surrenders to Krishna, Mukunda, who can give one liberation, even if one performs no yagyas, one is freed from all debts. Even if one does not repay his debts, he is freed from all debts if he renounces the material world for the sake of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose lotus feet are the shelter of everyone. This is the verdict of the Shastra. Therefore, Narad Muni was completely right in instructing the sons of Prajapati Daksha to renounce this material world immediately and take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unfortunately, Prajapati Daksha, the father of the Haryasvas and Savalasvas, did not understand the great service rendered by Narad Muni. Daksha therefore addressed him as Papa, the personality of sinful activities, and Asadhu, a non-saintly person. Since Narad Muni was a great saint and Vaishnava, he tolerated all such accusations from Prajapati Daksha. He merely performed his duty as a Vaishnava by delivering all the sons of Prajapati Daksha, enabling them to return home back to Godhead. So, here is a very good example that we see of the misunderstanding of the Vedic path, what it is actually for. Prajapati Daksha is very expert in the Vedic literatures and the Vedic activities. Therefore, his name is Prajapati. It means, or Daksha means, that he is expert. So when it comes to the activities of the Varnashram, the activities especially of parenthood, he's very expert. And he is also highly qualified because he is one of the sons of Brahma. So he is a brother of a contemporary of Narad Muni. So then, but the difference here is Narad Muni understands the essence of the Vedic literatures because he inquired. We see he inquired from his father, and then he gained from him what was the essence of the Vedic literatures and the Vedic culture. But Prajapati Daksha, he was dutiful. He's taken his work, he's doing it very nicely, but he did not inquire on what was the actual the essence of his work, what was the purpose of his work. So he's following the natural, the what Krishna calls as the slow path. It is Vedic, it is Krishna's path, but one moves along it in very, very slow movements, increments. That someone performs one's duties because there is material desire, and he feels it is his proper, by doing this duty, then that's, he pleases the Lord, and in this way he gains what he wants, whatever facilities and sense gratification one wants. And because one has done the duty, then one feels it is one's, you know, natural rightful claim to enjoy the fruits. And then in this way, one goes on in this lifetime and then in so many lifetimes, gradually elevating oneself through this process of karma until we get to jnana and then we come to yoga, then to liberation, like this. So the general thing is that since we're doing the activities for ourselves, then we owe something to somebody. Like a small child does activities, but because they're not conscious of what is going on, and they're not conscious, that they are not claiming anything so much. They don't say that all the property belongs to them and the wealth and all these different things. The father is claiming that. It is his house, it is his land. The child is just there and enjoying the benefits of that. But when the child gets mature and older, and then the father is able to hand over the properties and the wealth to the son, then he takes the debts. He then has to pay. Because when you take facilities, it's something that is owed. So when one takes on the responsibility and says, my activity is, the fruit is mine, then we have to understand that there is many people involved that are there. It means there's always some tax, right? Just like one performs an activity, one has business, one makes money, but one must give some tax to the government. One may say, why I have to give, right? It would be natural. At my work, I did the job, I sold the goods, why I don't get the full benefits. Because unseen to us, there is a government that is creating an atmosphere of discipline and peacefulness so that we can do our business. They have established the economy so that we can trade. There is a common understanding that this much goods is worth this much in wealth. So then there is something is there, though it is not seen. We do not see the government everywhere, but we can see by symptoms. People drive on certain sides of the road. You know, you're walking in some places at least. Water works, electricity works, sewage works. You know? So in some places they don't work. Debt is less, of course, naturally. Less obligation is there. But we see that there is some order to the society. So therefore we understand somebody's doing that, an intelligent man. So there's some debt is owed. So in the same way is that we know what is the scriptures that we can perform our prescribed duties and get the fruit that has been handed down to us through the sages. So we have a debt to them. The demigods, when we do the activity, we do the yajna, then they give that result. Then we have a debt to them. And then the Father, he has given us the body that we are able to now engage in these activities and get the fruits that we want. The body is given according to our previous desires. We have desires, we want to fulfill them. If we had no desires, we wouldn't have taken birth. Because desires there, we've taken birth. That has been made, facility has been made by the Father. So we have that debt to him. So now he will move on in his next life. So then by producing sons, then the father's son, or in other words, grandsons, then the son pays his debt to the father. Because then the father is interested in karma, so he goes to the heavenly planets, goes to the Pitri Loka. Then the son performs the Shraddha rites. Then after he goes, the grandchildren will continue that. So then the father will be situated nicely. Plus then those grandchildren, their debt to their father, then is that they perform those rites and they do for the next generation. So we see here is that it's all very much how you say, subjective in the approach, that it's for myself. I do the activity, I get the result, it's mine. So then naturally when I get annoyed with this process, after many, 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 you know, thousands and millions of lifetimes, then I see that I've done my duties all these millions of lifetimes, I've never been satisfied once. Just the anxiety that I did my duty, that got done. But the actual satisfaction I thought I would get, you know, the scriptures talked about and all that, you know, the heavenly planets and no one dies and all this kind of stuff, I didn't actually experience. Therefore, then one sees that the material world doesn't give us satisfaction, then one moves to the platform of jnana. And then from there, one rejects karma. And one just takes up the study of knowledge and all that. So then, because that also is self-centered, I suffered in the material world, and now I don't want to suffer anymore, and I want to be free from, I want to enjoy the happiness of being free from material suffering. So that's the liberation. So because the whole thing is actually motivated, personally motivated, therefore before you can go on to the higher one, you have to have performed the duties of the lower. So unless someone who is materialistic like this follows the Vedic culture for their own material purposes, unless they owe their debts to the saints, to the demigods, and to the Father, then they can't go on to that next step. It won't be successful. Instead, they'll go to hell, because then they're just running away from their duties. So now, this is the viewpoint of Prajapati Daksha, and well-founded in the Vedic literature. But what he doesn't understand, Narad Muni does. Because Narad Muni then heard all this and said, so this is it? This is the ultimate purpose and goal of life? That's all there is to life? Is just performing these duties, enjoying them, get fed up with them and trying to go to the Brahman? And Brahma said, no. He said, the actual purpose is devotion to the Lord. Then from that, we understand as if one does that, the scriptures, all that knowledge is coming from the Lord. The Lord himself is speaking. He originally speaks to Brahma. Brahma speaks to the sages. Then all these different gotras and lines come down. Then the Lord, he is the one who has expanded all his energies and does all the work of the demigods. And he is the original father. He is the one who puts the living entities, injects the living entities into the womb of material nature. Then one understands that's the real duty. That was what Narad Muni stated to the first brothers, like his first set of brothers, the Haryasvas. This is what he explained to them. The second ones he just said, do what your brothers did. But he explained this to them. So they understood this and they took up the path of devotion. So in the path of devotion, then these things of having children to perform the shraddhas for your father isn't important. Because you worship the Supreme Lord, you go back to Godhead. So all duties are done, plus all removing all the duties of karma are done by serving the Lord. All the duties of jnana are done by understanding the Lord. All the duties of yoga are done by being absorbed in thinking of the Lord. And then one goes back to Godhead. And by this, then so many generations before and after and yourself is free from the material contamination. So the whole purpose that was there in having the son was to perform shraddhas so that the father could enjoy on the heavenly planets. But now, by taking up devotional service, then they have freed the father not only from this, but from the whole material existence. So much higher. Means the platform of the Pitris is not that high. Their enjoyment isn't that high on the scale. There's demigods that are much higher happiness, and then you get into the Prajapatis, and then into, you know, Lord Brahma. Then you get into Brahman, like this. So though it's much higher than the humans, it's higher than the Gandharvas, but it is still not much above. I think it's what 100 times 100, and that's 10,000. Then times 100. Would be 1 million. So the Pitris, their happiness is 1 million times the humans. But that's only the third up on the scale. Above them, then you have the lower demigods, you have the normal demigods, you have Indra. Each one is 100 times more. Then you have Brihaspati, then you have the Prajapatis. Excuse me, you have Prajapatis, then Brihaspati, then you have Lord Brahma. Like that. And then that's just considered a drop in the ocean of Brahman happiness. And that's just a fraction of a portion in the unlimited ocean of devotional service. So it's not very great. So you're offering the happiness of going back to Godhead. It's a much greater gift. In fact, the father owes something to the son for this. It means the debts of the opportunity that the father gave and put us on the path, that is there. That debt is there for the son. And he's instructed and given the opportunity to engage one's nature in devotional service. But then a higher debt is even owed by the father. If the father's not a devotee and the son is. If the father's a devotee also, that's another thing. Then he's not like Prajapati Daksha. He wants his children to go back to Godhead. But he wants to see that they go through life properly. So this has been, is misunderstood here. Is it's like a cloud. The cloud of illusion is there. And the karmis and jnanis can't see that actually all the fruits and all the knowledge and all the potencies that they are seeing and dealing with come from the other side of the cloud. So they only see that these things come through the cloud. I did this activity, this happened. They don't actually understand that beyond that cloud is the Supreme Lord. And he is the one that when you do these things and he and his energies become pleased, and then they give all facilities. So this is, how do you say? So this is what's going on here. Interesting to also note in this is that there's also a point that if here Prajapati Daksha is calling him that he's not a sadhu. You know, he's called him not a sadhu, that he's sinful. So one of the aspects of sadhu, of a saintly person, is he's not attached to the material nature. He's not attracted or repulsed. He has no affection or hate. Like this, he's equal poised. Because of affection, material affection, he doesn't act, and because of material hate, he does not act. And he is not disturbed in the light of either. Someone may have affection for him, someone may hate him. It doesn't bother him. It's not a consideration. Someone who's trying to situate themselves on the platform of jnana, then generally means, how you say, they're worried about the hate side. They don't like people who don't like them, like that. Someone on the platform of karma, then they're worried about both, love and hate. They generally like to do things out of affection, love, and try to avoid those things of hate. But we see Narad Muni here is not doing, worried about that. Because after liberating his second group of sons, and Prajapati Daksha is in total anxiety, then Narad Muni simply, he doesn't think, well, if I go and see him or if Prajapati sees me now, he's going to be very upset and angry and say so many things and insult me and all these different things. He's not worried about that. He's thinking, according to Gita, that if someone is in anxiety, you know, then, and they are pious, it's natural for them, it's a good opportunity to surrender to the Lord. So Prajapati Daksha is definitely pious. You know, he's pious to the, you know, nth degree. But, and he is in total anxiety, so here's a great opportunity to preach to him. You know, we've liberated everybody else in his family, right? So why not him? Like that. He's the last one to go, right? So then he comes and tolerates all these insults. Otherwise, normally you'd stay away. Well, this guy's going to be upset. But he's not worried about that. Because his interest is just preaching. So we see that even though he calls him asadhu and says he's papa, we can see from this he's actually the real sadhu. Because he is not worried about these things. And though Daksha says he's the sadhu, he is sadhu in that he is following the duties. But he is not as high or a sadhu as Narad Muni, who understands the purpose of the duties. So then that comes out very good. Any questions on this? Then after this we'll go into something on the ground. Yes?
Two questions. One is, what are, this is actually a personal question, about Shraddha and devotees, and whether they, I mean, you're not on the level of the sons of, I mean, if I'm not on the level, but any of the sons of Bhakti. So to what extent are we, should we perform these duties?
Shraddha.
Particularly Shraddha. And the second question is, you've talked a lot about fathers and sons. What about mothers and fathers?
So, in the aspect of the duties, specifically of Shraddha and others in general, the material duties, then in there it's expected of respect is always there. The parents, we see the very good example, and Prabhupada mentions that, of Prahlad Maharaj. Even though he's a pure devotee, his father is like, you know, the essence of, you know, demon-ness, you know. And but still he dealt with his father always nicely. His father would say everything, he would stand there properly, you know, deal how he should, and listen, and then, but he doesn't have to agree. He's a, you know, individual living, he doesn't have to agree with the nonsense. But he never, you know, accuses and deals badly and speaks roughly and harshly and all that. And it's the duty of the son to think of the welfare of the father. So then, whatever platform that can be done, either on the material or spiritual, depending on the situation. So those remain, whether one's a devotee or not, however that one is situated, however advanced. Then on the Shraddh, then the elaborate Shraddha is important because of the father, if he's pious, goes to the Pitri Loka. And if he doesn't, if he goes to the hellish regions, then by performance of the Shraddha, they are freed from the hellish regions and they're situated in Pitri Loka. And then by the regular performance, the yearly performance, then all of their necessities are sent to them. You make so many bowls of rice, and that translates, it's a very good exchange rate. So those three bowls turn into 1 year's worth of food, you know. It's like, you know, coming with dollars to India, you know, you get a very good exchange rate, you know. But what'll keep you for 1 month in America, you know, you can live for a whole year here. So it's like that. Exchange rate is very good. So by performing those Shraddhas, then that keeps them there. And the son is materialistic, wants that. Father's materialistic, wants that. So it's a very nice exchange. Now, for the devotee, they don't bother with that. They just offer prasadam. They offer prasad to the departed personality. Then by taking that prasad, automatically they're freed from hellish conditions. And then they have done devotional service. So now they're not just on the pious platform. They're actually on the devotional platform, though, you know, just beginning stages. Now the opportunity for devotional service and all that has begun. So they've actually been put on a whole different path. So then all their, now, once they've done service, then Krishna takes care of them. Once somebody's done some service, Krishna doesn't let them go. So then that duty's been performed. One is then free, because now they're under Krishna's protection. So even if one is not so advanced oneself that by one going back to Godhead, they just become liberated, still they've been put on the devotional path where they will continue on their own. So in this way. And then whatever good credits are there for the son, something naturally goes. Just like for the king, whatever is there, because he takes the tax and he gives protection. From that tax he takes on, what is the percentage of the tax he takes? Like if he takes 18%, 1/6, he takes on 1/6 of the karma of the people, the bad karma. But he also takes on 1/6 of the good karma. So if they do nice work, he gets 1/6. If they do bad work, he also gets 1/6. And it's interesting, if he doesn't protect, he takes the tax that doesn't protect, he takes on 100% of the bad. He doesn't get any of it, he only gets the bad, but 100%. Like that. So then something all naturally all will always go, to some degree. But it's you know, the more advanced and also the more qualified the parent, then the more they also may receive. Like that. So for the devotees, they don't have to worry. Basically, the dealings are very nice, very proper. If they can help in any way, they do. But they don't compromise the devotional path for, they won't give up the devotional path to, for the duties, because they're on the higher, they're doing the duties to the higher father in that. Though the etiquettes and the social dealings are always, have to be very proper. There's not a great tolerance in the Vedic culture to improper dealings with even bad parents, as we see by example of Prahlad.
So we should perform a very simple shraddha, yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
We don't do and the regular every year shraddha.
It's not necessary. That's not necessary. The one time is mainly enough. There has been a little bit more. I think the Devananda Gaudiya Math put together from a padati that's more simple, that's taking the essential elements out of the whole elaborate Vedic thing and putting into it all the Krishna conscious aspects. So that's specifically important if the parents are someone who they themselves expect the whole Vedic rite to go on. So then they would do all those rituals and everyone would see, oh, the pot is being established. So they're thinking Ganesh is going inside, but instead, you know, Guru and Gauranga and Radha Krishna have gone inside. And then they see the Yajna is going on, so they think all the different demigods, but they, you know, it's actually is worshiping all the Lord, his associates, his energies. So like that, then there's the whole ritual is there. So externally, because the karmi is mainly interested in the externals and the results. So if he sees the externals, then he's satisfied the result will come. So when those externals are done, but in a Krishna conscious way, then the result comes, but it's much higher level. They don't even expect, can't expect like that. But if one's in a situation where one doesn't have parents like that, then just our simple, you know, take prasad and feed devotees, and then after everyone's fed, then make a plate and put a picture and offer that to them, that they get the Lord's remnants after feeding the devotees, and then after that they take. Because it's the normal. In other words, they are like the host. The host always offers, cooks prasadam, offers to the Lord, feeds his guests, sees that other members of the family and servants and everybody is taken care of, then last sits and eats. You know, it's like the husband and wife, they may sit together and eat or just like that. But everyone else, even the servants in the Vedic household, even the servants have been taken care of before the husband and wife of the house eat. They may not eat at that time or they serve them, but they've given them their share. So if there is a shortage, the shortage goes on the householder, not on their guests or dependents. Like that. So then at the end, then they take. So that is done by, generally by the son. That's always the first. If it's not, then, you know, then a brother, the wife, the daughter, anybody can do it. Or a Brahmin, or a village leader, you know, somebody who knows them and there's some kind of connection. You know, like that. So that's there. The daughters for the mother mainly is the imbibing the training. Imbibing the training. Because for the mother is going to get the results of the father. You know, the mother will get, of her husband, like that, or father, whoever she is dependent upon. So she's taken care of in that way. So that whatever they do, like if the father goes to Pitri Loka, she goes there. As long as she is, the chastity is there, that concentration is there. Or if he goes to the heavenly planet, she goes. She goes back to Godhead, she goes. So she just simply, she has the option, as non-devotees, then is thinking of the husband. And then whatever benefits he got, she gets automatically, like that. So everybody has that equal opportunity, but it's just through different mediums. You know, the wife gets the same benefit of personal service to the guru by performing the household duties. So it becomes very easy and natural. The household duties is the house, you like to take care and do all the things and putter around and do. For that, you get the same benefit as the brahmacharya has to be very sense controlled and then do personal service for the guru. You know, like that. So the same benefits are there, but they just do it through the different mediums. Like that. So then the daughter gains from the mother her mood so that she then is able to follow nicely the husband, the son, the father, You know, or she becomes very strong in devotional service and remembers the Lord herself directly. So the woman can think of the Lord, spiritual master, go back to Godhead, or think of the husband and get whatever benefits he's accrued. Therefore, in the Vedic culture, the girls would be very careful to marry those who were, you know, very pious, very devotional, because then they automatically, just by being in that house and interacting with that person, get the same benefits. Or if they marry someone who's not, then it doesn't leave them a whole lot of option, you know, like that. So previously the girls would be very worried to get a very, you know, pious and nice husband, and then, you know, on top of that, if he looks nice and he's wealthy, then that's, you know, bonus, you know. But the main they would look at is devotional, piety, good culture, like that. Does that answer?
So then you could say that the debt to the father, there's also a debt to the mother, which is satisfied through the debt to the pious.
Yes.
In terms of the debt.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Means basically what is happening is the girl is helping her father, husband, or son in removing their debt. And because they get that benefit, she gets that benefit. Like that. It just comes automatic. So the whole idea in the Vedic culture is to establish relationships. Because that the father, if he doesn't properly train the child, both in the way of proper behavior and culture, the son's not going to perform the activities. So by that proper performance, that proper training, then that relationship is established. And unless he himself behaves in a way that the son feels indebted, he may not do those duties. So relationship has to be established. And then in this, then the girl and the wife has these particular duties. That's for establishing a relationship between them. So that the whole idea is that the rules establish relationship. They're for the purpose of personal. But somehow or another, many times when one gets too materialistic or they're not understood, the rules make things impersonal. But the Vedic culture was designed is that the rules are in such places to create a particular mentality and relationship. Like we were just reading yesterday, that a sannyasi, he means anybody who's interested in spiritual upliftment, then has to be very careful not to disturb or kill other living entities, either by sacrifice or unintentionally. So then, but for the sannyasi, they especially have to be very careful of this. So it mentions that the sannyasi should be very careful to watch wherever he walks. He has to pay particular attention to that. So then by doing that, then it creates a focus on the duty. One is not, you know, looking around and enjoying the ambience. And then it becomes a very prominent in his mind of how he has to be kind, merciful, or that attention to other living entities, the super soul is in their heart. So it brings out a whole transformation of the consciousness just by making that rule. Now, if one's materialistic, one's only interested in Gyanakanda, then he is very proud that he looks very nicely and he's very beautiful and he's better than everybody. You know, like here Daksha is saying, I am the sadhu and you're not the sadhu. Because he's proud of his performance of duties. You know, this fault of daksha is not just something of the grihastha ashram. This is something of any of the ashrams or any of the varnas if they're proud of their duties. It's just when there's Veda garbha, or here it's the duties. When the garbha is there, the pride, then they take up this mentality. They've done their duty and they become proud and they become impersonal. But what's supposed, as we see with his own daughter, he was proud of his abilities and that. So even his own daughter, Sati, you know, he ignored her, and which is, you know, the worst thing for a daughter, you know, is the father to ignore. So then the pain was so much that she then left the body. So we can see is he's very proud. He's expert, but he's become proud of that expertise. So the purpose of the rules is actually to create humility, relationships, interaction, you know, the exchange with those who we're dealing with, and as the Bhagavatam points out, specifically with the Lord and the devotees. That's what they're actually for. So the Bhagavatam then gives this in this light. as we see here. It means from the philosophy we actually understand what's the real culture. It means Daksha should have been happy. He is the son of Brahma. He is supposed to perform his duties. The only reason that people are to have children, Brahma wants people to have children. He tells his sons to have propagate, you know, and have children, is so that all the living entities that have been injected into the material world in the glance of Mahavishnu have the opportunity to take bodies so they can go back to Godhead. So here already, you know, in the first, you know, first very short while, then Daksha's, you know, 11,000 children have gone back to Godhead. I mean, this is pretty good record. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, it's pretty good odds, you know. So but he's not understanding that that's what the thing. He's just seeing the order's been given to produce progeny, but the production of progeny is to give them the opportunity to go back to Godhead. So therefore, it says, don't become a mother, a father, a teacher, a guru, presiding demigod, unless you can save them from death. So Daksha is having the children, but he's not worried about that side of his duty. He's just doing the duty to have the children. But he's not seeing that he has to release them. Otherwise, he'd be very happy. In this way, he could just go on having, you know, he can decide how many children he's going to have. He's so expert. That's why he's called expert. Well, next time he should have 100,000, you know, and then he can just keep going back to Godhead. You know, he should be happy with this. You know, it's very, very, very good process, you know. Like that. And he's missing that point, like that. So, what to do? Somebody's got to set the example.
The point made about a woman, if she does household duties, she gets equal benefit of the brahmachari performing different austerities.
Yeah.
I've heard that sometimes. Where is that reference?
That's in the Manasamhita. That's in the Manasamhita. There it mentions that there's three aspects. Do you remember? By performing the household duties, it's the same as performing personal service to the guru. You know, like the brahmachari does antevas. He lives in the forest with the guru for however many years it is. And during that time, he's rendering personal service.
Did Prabhupada pull that out at all in his preaching of duties of the lady?
I haven't gotten to that. I haven't come across it. I haven't come across it. But he mentions, if you want to know the details of the social structure, then you refer to Manu, Yajnavalkya, and Parasara, like that. He's mentioned it for those. Because these are mostly these aspects are handed down in the family. And the Manasamhita is specifically for those who are going to lead the society. Everybody knows the general points of it, what applies to them. But to know the overall is specifically for those who are going to organize the society. You know, the big organizer of the society are those Brahmins involved in that kind of thing. Because then it gets so much into law and everything like that. But in this, it just tells the proper exchange between husband and wife, between the parents and the children and their parents, between the teachers, the parents and those in the community. It gets into a lot of much of that detail Prabhupada mentions in the purports throughout, like that. But we see is that the essential principle is the side. See, is that you have different levels. There's ones that there's the duty, that this is what one does. And the duty is there because it's come from the Lord. The Lord has established the culture, the Vedic culture, as the culture of the, how you say, how to move in the material world. Krishna comes, he follows that culture, and then he's given this culture for the devotees. Then those who are non-devotees, so that they don't create trouble, they are also given opportunity to follow this. So for them, they'll generally only follow it if they understand all the material benefits. So this is specifically an explanation of the point of that the lady of the house will be taking care of the house, taking care of the children, assisting the husband in his service, and in that aspect of it, the aspect of prescribed duty. So if one wants to know why, then this is it. she gets all the same things that the husband got by going through the whole Brahmacharya ashram and everything like that. And nowadays, many, you know, the men haven't gone through the Brahmacharya ashram, but the women still get their benefits. So, you know, like that. But that's more just what's the fruit, the result. So much, many of the times we see Prabhupada doesn't explain those ones so much, because if one wants to know, they're there. But it's important in the Manasamhita is that one has to be able to see it as Narad Muni has given it to us. So the essence of that we see in the Bhagavatam when Narad Muni instructs Yudhishthira, like that, is that all the essential principal foundational points of the Dharma Shastra are there in the seventh canto, explained by Narad Muni to Yudhishthira. Then all the technical things like Pancharan asks about Shraddha, then there'll be pages and pages how to technically perform it, who's qualified to be fed, all these things. But as devotees, we don't worry about that. It means a devotee is automatically has all the good qualities. So if we feed devotees, we've taken care of 20 pages of explanation already. You know? And if we worship Krishna, we don't have to worry about the demigods and the Buddhas and all these other personalities. So we worship the Lord, we have some kirtan, we discuss some philosophy, we distribute prasad to the devotees, then we offer to that person. So we've done everything. But for those who are not devotees, then it gets expanded because they want the result, so therefore then they have to technically go through. There's no grace for them. You know, someone who's a nice, like a child, there's grace for them. They do so many things and it doesn't matter because their mood is proper. But when the mood is not proper, you know, the child is just wanders around, is smiling and happy and drops things all over the house and everything like that, the mother picks it up, no one minds. But if the child gets upset and is spoiled, mother's told him, you can't do this, and he goes out, starts throwing things around the house, and she'll come out and say, pick that up. You know, that goes here. This is Krishna's, you know, book. You can't throw it on the floor. So the grace is taken because the mentality becomes materialistic. But as soon as it's innocent, oh, then so much is there. You know, it's just the relationship, because Krishna just takes care of the devotees. All these things, you don't have to worry about because you're relating to him. If you're not relating to him, okay, I am getting everything done in the material world. So now if you relate to me, all your duties are taken care of. If you don't relate to me, I just happen to be running this world through 33 million demigods. So therefore, you owe a debt to all 33 million. You know, fat chance you're going to pay it back, but, you know, go for it. You know, you're the doer, right? You know, you're the enjoyer, so go for it. You know, then you have all these sages, then you have all your forefathers and your family, you know. So that's how you're there. So you have those duties, do it. Therefore, the Vedic literature has become very exacting in that. But for the devotees, that's all basically cleared away. The fundamental elements are all, the Prabhupada's mentioned them all. So if one does them and, you know, just accepts that this is the culture, tries to see what's the philosophy behind it, it goes very nicely. And if one wants to know more technically, then the Shastras will explain it. But you have to know what's the principle behind it, because they're written in language for materialists. Right? Bhagavatam, that's what's so nice about it. It's written for devotees. All the materialistic language is removed. But the Manasamhita is written for karmis. It means those who are pious, interested in intuitive activities. So it uses words and terminologies that they'll relate to. And unfortunately, devotees won't relate to. Or let's say, fortunately. So the devotee has to know how to translate those. What is the term in the materialistic vocabulary, and what is its root? In other words, you have the reflection of the spiritual culture in the material world is the pure Vedic culture, Daivavarnashram, for going back to Godhead. Then you have the perversion of that into karma and jnana. So you have to translate the perverted terminologies and it's not the terminology, but the thrust of the terminologies into the actual original terminologies of or understandings of the Daivavarnashram. Then it becomes quite useful. But otherwise, then it's not. Because it's written for karmas. It's written to get them to follow, you know? It means we do something, we chant Hare Krishna, you know, because it pleases Krishna. Then someone's not interested in that. Okay, we can free you from material suffering. Like that. So then, okay, then I can relate to that. So many the pious persons who come to Krishna in the beginning, they're in anxiety. They want to be freed from that anxiety. So they'll take up chanting and doing all the devotional process because it frees them from the anxiety. So some materialistic tinge is there. But because it's done for Krishna, one is purified anyway. Right? The small spot of materialism, you know, can't stand in the light of, you know, an ocean of devotion. Like that. Devotional service is so powerful. So even though someone comes because of anxiety of money or other things, it won't stop the holy name and the devotional process from acting. So then with time, then they come to understand is actually I'm chanting Hare Krishna because it pleases Krishna. And I have a relationship with Krishna. But otherwise, there's always, if one doesn't have that mode, then there's always written in the next, like, net. You know, it's like on trapeze or something. You fall off, then you have some nets to catch you. So it's like those nets of, if you don't follow this, then, I mean, if you follow this, then you'll be freed from material, you know, suffering and all that. So the aspect of, I say, liberation is there. If not, then at least, you know, everything's pious. It'll go nicely. You please the Lord, and then all your needs are taken care of. And if not, then someone who's a materialist and is not exactly perfect in all their Vedic duties will go to hell. And then of all the Vedic duties, then chanting japa is the most important, or the holy name is the most important. So therefore, I will get the benefit of all Vedic yajnas and sacrifice by chanting Hare Krishna. So that's there also in the Manusamhita. It doesn't say Hare Krishna. It just mentions about chanting the Gayatri and that. Because that was, in other ages, that is the Brahma's japa. Their japa is just the Brahma Gayatri. They don't have another japa unless they've taken up the process of Pancharatra, you know, or they've come in contact with Narad Muni, you know, some devotee. So it's said by chanting the holy, by chanting the Gayatri, they get the benefit. Even if they don't know the shastras, they don't know, I mean, all the Vedic literatures, they don't know all the yajnas, they don't do all those yajnas. A Brahmin who just absorbs himself in chanting the Gayatri, that is his sadhana. He's the best of all the Brahmanas. He gets all the benefits that anyone else gets. So that's the backup for just the thing. If you just chant Hare Krishna, then all other sacrifices are taken care of. Okay. And then we take it more as that saves yourself. But now if you do it in good association, Sankirtan, then there's even more benefit. Okay. Does that make some sense? So it's just the... That's why the Bhagavatam is the most important scripture, because it actually gives the conclusions of all the other scriptures. Like that. It gives all the conclusions of all the other scriptures. So here we see the conclusions of the Dharma. You know, this point of our debt to the forefathers, the debt to the father, debt to the demigod, is now being brought out and highlighted. You know, and so then like this, so many points in the Bhagavatam, they come out. What is the relationship? Like we see Kapila Muni, then his duty, he takes care of his mother, trains his mother in Krishna consciousness. Then his father, he goes to the forest. You know, everybody involved, their duties as devotees, individual devotees, to take up Krishna consciousness. So that you see the material duties being taken care of in their proper format, you know, the actual transcendental understanding, and each individual's, you know, more important duties of Krishna consciousness. So the Bhagavatam is like the perfect example of that. And then sets all the foundation. Chaitanya Charitamrita then gives us even more detail how, specifically as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, how to accomplish the same activities like that. What time is it?
9:00.
9:00. Didn't get around much to Lord Ramachandra. There's supposed to be a class at 10 in the temple on this. But it's not specifically just, I think it's for part of their program. So. kind of in light of this, then we see that the Ramlila is a very wonderful example of the Dharma of the essential elements of the Daiva Varnashram being shown. Is that any of the Lord's pastimes, but especially in this pastimes of Ramachandra, all these aspects are brought out very much. As we see in Dwarka, that's just kind of a transformation of Braja. You bring in the rules and regulations, it's still 16,108 queens, and you know, they do all kinds of things, and you know, no one can figure out who Krishna is. Is he a Brahmin? Is he a Kshatriya? Is he Vaishya? You know, what is he? You know, because sometimes he's acting like this, sometimes like that. So in the Ramachandra's pastimes, and the moon is that of Maryada, that of just very nicely following the duties, and then the interactions that are created from that. One will see that the Ramayana, because it's based on duty, it's emotionally a very heavy scripture, like that. The flavors, it's always bringing out the emotional exchange that is happening between, you know, the Lord and his devotees. You know, the Hanuman, you know how you say? Hanuman, he's gone to Lanka, you know, for Ram. You know, it's not that just... It's just the duty, but it's the duty and friendship here. They've created a bond. They're friends. And then Sugriva is like, you know, another king who's been benefited. His brother, who was not behaving properly, was behaving in an improper way, then was then removed by the help of Ram. And Sugriva was able to then get back his rightful kingdom and then perform his duties there. So that bond between Sugriva and Ramachandra, and how he had a duty, you know, to, or a debt to help him now get his wife and kingdom back. So, but in this, then we see also the aspects of friendship that Lord Ramachandra, that Sugriva has been suffering for so long, you know, that he's been separated from his wife, separated from his position, and had to live in the forest, and everything's been unjust. He's been unjustly accused. So very painful things on a personal level. And then Ramachandra has come, and by killing his brother, Bali, then he has then set all this straight and reestablished his position, his relationships in his family, his relationships with his subjects, all that. So then everything is going very nicely. So naturally, then Ramachandra, it's like not immediately, okay, I did this, so you know, let's go look for my wife. But now it's a matter of, it's understood so long of the pain, and now some time will be there while he becomes, you know, absorbed in the happiness of having been resituated back in these relationships. So Ram then lets it go for some time. But then when he sees that, you know, okay, just happened just before the rainy season. Rainy season is there. One can't go much here and there. It's a time for contemplation anyway. You know, study the scriptures, association with sadhus, performing devotional activities. Then, okay, he absorbs himself like that. He won't be overly worried about going and looking for his wife. So then, but then that season is over. So 4 months have gone by. It's plenty of time. But Sugriva has become a little bewildered now in the relationships. He's forgotten that he's supposed to perform these relationships for the purpose of remembering the Lord. So he's gotten bewildered by, you know, his wife and all the position and facilities and all that. So then he's reminded of that, you know, by the twang of Ramachandra's bow. And just by that pulling of the string. You know, we have to understand is these bows were not ordinary bows. They're not what we know of bows are, you know, you untie them, they basically stay straight. Or, you know, a little bit more fancy, the ends are curved a little bit. They call those compound bows. So the Vedic bows would curve in a C. The compound was so, it wasn't that they were straight and then the tips curved. Except for the handle, everything curved. they were such powerful bows. So it was a very, that's why you see Ramachandra stringing the bow, Lord Shiva's bow, is a very unique thing. And Arjuna coming, stringing the bow, and then shooting the fish in the, moving in the wheel by looking in the water. Because stringing those bows were not an ordinary, not just anyone could do them. It's even been seen that the bows that were used by the Hunas, you know, when they invaded Europe, they'd make them out of laminated bone, right? They start building them when they were kids. So by the time they were mature adult, then they had this thing that had been built over, you know, 15, 20 years. And you could fire an arrow, and it didn't matter what nice armor all those, you know, Western, you know, kings and soldiers are wearing, they'd go straight through them. It didn't matter. They were so powerful, and they do this on horseback. So even in contemporary times, you had bows that were more powerful than even the best bowmen or, how you say, you know, these weightlifters could pull now. So let alone back those. So it was a very unique thing. So pulling one of those bows and letting the string go will make a very, very loud and strong sound. So just, and for Kshatriyas, you know, they're tuning into the sound of the string of the bow is very much part of their training, you know, because you can also, an arrow is shot properly, you can tell by the sound. You know, the release will be perfect, the sound will be perfect. So then, all these, also the Kshatriya wears as their girdle, as a brahmachari, they wear a bowstring. They don't wear like kusa grass like the Brahmins, they wear a bowstring. And that's what they hold up their underwear with. So the bowstring is very essential. So we see just by that, it's a simple thing. One could say there's so much politics, so much other different things in the Kshatriya, but just the thing that gets right to the heart immediately is the bowstring. So just Ramachandra just pulls his bow, and that sound just brings Sugriva out of his bewilderment in a moment. And immediately it's like, okay, where the man, let's, you know, all these different things. And he's ready to go. So then that relationship, how that's established. Then we see that when they find Jatayu. And then Jatayu and his brother, and how they are able to see their relationship, how Jatayu's brother had saved him. They were flying, they were big, these Cheyenne eagles. So they fly from planet to planet, that's kind of their airspace. Like that. They only come here for a few, you know, elephants and, you know, large tortoises or whatever, you know, big object they can pick up. And so they were flying to the sun, and it got so hot that they were burning, that the older brother went above the younger brother to protect him. And then in that, then his feathers got burnt, and he fell down to earth. And he was laying there at this spot since that time. And Jatayu was saved, so he would come and bring things for his brother and take care and all that. So we see that that relationship there, that tight relationship. Then Jatayu, he had been, you know, saved and protected in this way, and they're very, you know, honorable birds. I mean, they speak in Sanskrit and stuff. So we see that he, then those duties of them, when he saw that Sita was being taken away by a Rakshasa, he came to stop like that, because he knows the scriptures, you know, Rakshasas aren't supposed to be taking nice ladies. They can walk off with, you know, other Rakshasa ladies, and can come for Yakshasas and Nagas and all those kind of, you want to catch a Gandharva here and there, okay, but you don't walk off with queens, you don't walk off with sages' wives. You know, this is not the how you say, the right of the Rakshasa. So then he immediately, for dharma duty, then he comes and gets in the way. And then in that, then he gets his wings cut off. So then, you know, so that's, you know, very emotional scene, that he is performed those duties. He's, I mean, in other words, that duty of protection, you know, of the, how you say, that relationship that's established, these things, they're very, very strong. Then we see Hanuman, then when they get to the ocean, then Hanuman is then he is forgotten. He doesn't know what his powers are. So they're trying to find out who can jump to Lanka. And that. And so then because Jatayu's brother can see Sita at Lanka. So then, different ones, some can jump, you know, so many yojanas and all that, but no one can jump the whole thing. Was it 800 or 100? 800 yojanas. Some can jump 600, some 400, some, you know, like that. No, it's but only Hanuman can jump that. So then, let's see. The bear, Jambavan. Then he reminds him, because it's he has the power, but someone has to remind him of it. Because when he was a kid, he made too much trouble, so he totally forget how powerful he is. Like that. So then he reminds, and then out of, not because he's so strong, but out of the affection for Ramachandra, then he assumes these powers. He becomes huge, huge form. And then he decides he's going to jump. So then on this side of where the all the other monkeys are, all they hear is rah. And he's gone. And then over in Lanka, you hear the like that, so he jumped across. So he's using those in the Lord's service. So these aspects are very, very strong, you know, the culture there. Then he gets there, he meets Sita, and you know, he brings something, he behaves very nicely as a servant, because he is a servant of Ram, so then naturally Ram's wife is a servant. I mean, he is a servant of her. And gives the message, takes the message, all that, offers to, how you say, take her back, because he can take her back and one leave. But then, you know, she makes the point, no, it's the duty of the husband. He will come, like that, so she'll wait. And then he takes back this ring and that, and then he shows it to Lakshman. And then Lakshman doesn't know if it's Sita's or not. Oh no, it wasn't a ring. It was, I think, something from the hair. There's an ornament in the hair there. What do you call it?
Chudaman.
Chudaman. Like that. So then Lakshman doesn't know, even though he's a married man, but because he's come as Ram's servant to protect, he's acting as a servant. So servants don't look above the waist of the women in the house. You know, they have, you know. He has his own wife. He's left her back in Ayodhya. He may look at her, but he doesn't look at anyone else's. So he doesn't know. You know, if he had an ankle bell, or maybe the wrist, I mean the waist bells, or possibly a bangle, he might know, but he doesn't know what's above that. So just that relationships that are there. Then they go to Lanka, and we see, you know, what they're doing there, the activities, and when they get there, then it's time, okay, the Rakshasas, they see what a powerful army it is. So then it's decided by the commanders in chief, okay, we have to see who is serious here. And so they made a line. They said, anybody on the right, those who want to go ahead with this war, you stand on the right. Those who don't, you stand on the left. So they were facing Lanka, and there was the beach, and then there was the ocean on the right. On the left is the other part of the land. So everybody goes so far to the right, they're all standing out in the water. You know, they don't want it to be mistaken that they're anywhere close to the left. Like that. So, like this, the whole, I say, then, you know, the battle comes, then so many relationships there, you know, Hanuman gets the mountain, and then Robin is killed, then coming back to Ayodhya, then, you know, Bharat spends this whole time just managing the kingdom from outside as just a servant of Ram. So all these we see here is because of the duty, the emotional exchange is very, very deep, very deep. Because when duty is there, and you know what is the purpose of that duty, and that creates a very, you know, strong bonding in the relationships. Therefore, you see is that such a strong, you know, there's millions and millions of persons who are like Ram Bhaktas, and it's because the it's a, you know, very nice blend between the emotions of dharma and the transcendental platform, because these are all being done for the Lord. So then it's very easy for those who are very interested in Dharma, and that very natural for them to be Ram Bhaktis, because the perfection of all the Dharma that they're performing is being done by Ram and his devotees, like this. So that is just in light of this verse, some of the actions. So I think we'll end here. Shri Ramachandra ji ki, Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shri Prabhupada ki, Jaini Dai Gaura Prema. So I think we'll end here. Shri Ramachandra ji ki, Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Jaini Dai Gaura Prema.